My name is Steve Fake. I'm the Director of Outreach at Just World Books and Just World Educational, and I'm here with Karine Aguilar-San Juan, co-editor of The People Make the Peace, Lessons from the Vietnam Anti-War Movement.
And this is not Democracy Now.
And this is not Democracy Now.
But I wish it were.
Next interview. Can you just start out by telling us a little bit about the origins of the book and how it came to be and what its motivation was?
Oh, yeah. Doing it? Well, The People Make the Peace is a collection of firsthand reflections by people who were, in their day, very prominent anti-war activists protesting the Vietnam War. And how it came to be is through a conversation that I had with Frank Joyce, who I befriended on a trip to Vietnam, and some work that I had been doing on Susan Sontag. Susan Sontag went to Vietnam in 1968, and she was essentially invited or kind of like steered towards going to Vietnam by Tom Hayden. So it turns out there's a group of 200 U.S. activists or intellectuals or writers who went to Vietnam during the Vietnam War. So in a sense, consorting with the enemy. So they risked treason, and some of them in the early travelers had their passports revoked, but the state Supreme Court then ruled that that travel was actually lawful. So I had the idea that of these 200, there must be some people still living. I mean, they include very interesting people like Pete Seeger, who, you know, pretty recently died. The first people to go were Tom Hayden and I'm forgetting his name now, the historian, Herb Aptheker, who was a communist. Mm. And Herb Aptheker went to Vietnam, and the Vietnamese said, when you go back to the U.S., try to find your non-communist friends so we can expose U.S. people to, and people around the world, to what's really going on in the war, so they can have their own firsthand experience and not just believe everything that the media is telling them. So Herb then went to Tom, who was very active in SDS at that time, and then Tom found his friend Staunton Lynn, who was older than him, who was a historian at Yale University. And after this, I don't know if it's after this trip, but as a result of his Vietnam anti-war activism, Staunton Lynn never worked at Yale again, or ever took a university post again, as far as I know. So Tom and Staunton became the first on this kind of like study circuit to Vietnam. I call it a work study trip, or travel study circuit, because what actually the North Vietnamese created kind of like a set tour where they would meet you, bring translation, you know, bring guides who could speak your language, and then show you various aspects of the country. And remember, they were at war, so bombing was happening and whatever. So this is really unusual for a country to do this. Although I guess many of Just World Books readers would know that, you know, Palestine does that. So, well, or at least they encourage traveling.
Yeah, delegations and so on.
Yeah. Maybe, you know, an interesting conversation we probably don't have time for now would be to talk about how the Palestinians and the Vietnamese, you know, how their strategies differ in terms of their world diplomacy.
Yeah.
But Vietnam, in a lot of ways, intentionally and strategically shaped the U.S. anti-war movement through this set of invitations to Americans to come and stay and see for yourself these various sites and talk to various people during the war. So Frank then approached his friend John McAuliffe, who is a contributor to the book and one of the 10 contributors to the book. And John and Frank together, for a year over the phone, the three of us talked, and they kind of, from memory, they didn't look at any websites, they didn't do any, like, archival research, they just, from memory, chatted about who they knew who went on these trips. And it was amazing, because they would say, oh, well, you know, well, there was Tom, but don't you think we should talk about Gabe? Well, then, I don't know, what would Jane say about that? And so I would just guess, because I had read enough, like, okay, Tom Hayden, Jane Fonda, Gabriel Kolko, you know, it was just like the
filling
first
the
name.
Blanks.
Yeah, I would guess like Gabe must be Gabriel, so Gabriel must be. You know. I ended up generating a list of the people they knew, and then we started paring down, like, who would they actually invite, because they would remember a lot of people who had passed away, too, or people who were still alive but maybe couldn't, too frail to go, like, Bettina, suddenly forgetting her name, too, Elizabeth Martinez, Bettita Martinez, who was known as Elizabeth Sutherland during the Civil Rights era, and then, but now she's known as Bettita Martinez, and she wrote the 500 Years of Chicano History.
Mm.
And so, you know, we had spoken to her, but she wasn't in good enough health to make this pretty vigorous trip, you know, 24 hours on a plane, and then plus they were going to get on a train, which turned out to be really strenuous because the cars are really small, and you sleep on these really small bunks, and there's a hilarious photo in the book, not really hilarious, but it's amusing, because you see Rennie, who's a large person, with Alex, who's also a large person, and Judy Gumbo all in one train car together, and so part of the trip, John McAuliffe helped organize this trip in line with the 40th commemoration of the Paris Peace Accords, the signing of the Paris Peace Accords, which were signed on January 27th, 1973. So it's a national holiday in Vietnam around that, and so they had televised events, and everyone who decided to make this trip was then treated as a foreign dignitary.
This was 2013?
Yeah, 2013. So I should back up by saying that when I said to John, let's make a book of people that you know who were part of this group of 200 who were invited during the war, not just every Vietnam activist, because there are millions of Vietnam anti-war activists we could have spoken to, but to pare it down to a kind of group that's somewhat similar, I thought it'd be interesting to just pick people in that group.
Yeah.
As it turns out, John is at the very, very tail end, and in some ways doesn't really qualify in this group, but he has a very interesting history in that he arrived in Vietnam on April 30th, 1975, the day the war ended. Not because they knew that would end then, but because he was working for the American Friends Service Committee, and they, knowing that the war would end, they were going to go set up programs there. And so he arrived on that very day, and so in our book he has some pictures of that day, which was a very joyful day for the Vietnamese revolutionary, revolutionary society.
Yeah. You and Frank write in the introduction that successive presidents since the war has ended have twisted the meaning and public memory of the Vietnam War. Can you talk about how the memory of the war has been twisted? And you also kind of reference, like, the Vietnam syndrome, quote unquote, mm-hmm. that Bush Sr. and many others bemoaned.
Mm-hmm. How to start with that? Let's see. Well, on some level, I would say there is no memory of the anti-war movement. And then the memory of the war itself is very cloudy and, if we can make a verb out of it, Forrest Gumpified. I think there's a historian named David Steigerwald who teaches at Ohio State who teaches about the anti-war movement, and he writes that when he presents the war and the anti-war movement to his students, a very large group of students at Ohio State, really all they know is the Forrest Gump image, mm-hmm. of a set of cartoon figures who weren't very serious in any of their decision making, and who lead you to feel that the war was somehow bad, but in the end we don't really know either why it was fought, or even if it was necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah.
So there's a weird kind of like anti-war feeling that ends up being twisted into a pro-war, almost pro or accepting of war mentality. And yeah, I mean, you can go through every president right after, I'm forgetting the exact detail, but I nobody wants to repeat the errors of Vietnam. But what people understand to be those errors is very different for different warmongering presidents. And so not wanting... So Vietnam syndrome means not that we went to war in Vietnam, but that we're afraid of losing a war.
Yeah.
And so people would use Vietnam as a reason to fight harder, when what they don't understand is that the U.S. had already pulled out all stops and had used more tons of bombs on Vietnam plus chemical warfare than they had used in World War II. So, you know, if you take your cues from the French movie Loin du Vietnam, Far from Vietnam, it's an anti-war movie that came out in 1965 or 1967 and was reissued in 2013. And it's a great film to watch because there is no U.S. equivalent of that film, even now, that is outright against the war. And in the first 2 minutes of the film, I don't know if it's the voice of Jean-Luc Godard or another one of these New Wave French filmmakers, but he says, Vietnam was a war of the rich against the poor.
Hmm.
And for the French, who had colonized Vietnam, to understand that, you know, you can see how, what mental process they would have to go through as a nation to understand that.
What was the name of the film again?
Far from Vietnam.
You know, I was going to ask you about the Forrest Gump caricature of the movement, because I thought it was such a striking passage in your introduction. And, you know, I remember myself when I was 14 or 15, I remember thinking, not having seriously researched the anti-war movement of the 60s, 70s, my impression of the movement was that there was a lot of people with strong feelings, but that they were basically just idiots.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't know what they were talking about.
Yeah, they were drawn into, you know, a frenzy, and they were into hanging out with their friends.
Yeah.
Which, you know, every movement has that component, right? It's like, well, you join it because you know somebody who's in it. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you have no thought process behind it, that you're selfish, that you're even dangerous.
Yeah.
And so a big part of this book, and even something I learned from this book is to see the deep kind of like at a deep level of the decision making that went on for the people who were young at that time. Like, the youngest in our book was Jay Craven. He was 19. I mean, he's still the youngest because for obvious reasons, but he was 19 when he kind of got involved in the anti-war movement. And something that he talks about is that the counterculture was in the air. It wasn't that he made a conscious decision to change his mind. It was that every song he listened to, every movie he watched, every concert he went to, every time he opened the newspaper, every time he turned on the TV, there were messages that he did think about. He didn't unknowingly just get, like, kind of, you know, like a zombie, you know, get absorbed into this. But it was reinforced by the culture to have some kind of questioning attitude about the war and about authority and so on and so forth. And so when he got influenced by Howard Zinn, who was one of his professors, and then later by Rennie Davis, who he followed to Vietnam, and actually later followed also to India when Rennie moved on to his other kind of spiritual adventures, Jay Craven, you know, proceeded to be very changed by his activism on Vietnam. And up to now, he's a filmmaker who sees that the arts are a realm for political education, and he's taken that really seriously, like, his whole life. So even though I knew that I should take these activists seriously, it was a different thing to actually read each of their stories and to see what risks they took, how they were frightened, how they didn't know whether they were making the right decision or not. They didn't join the movement because they knew it would win.
Yeah.
They just joined because they thought it was necessary and important.
Yeah. One of the things that I think comes through really strongly from this book that I didn't necessarily appreciate before was the depth of citizen diplomacy, and that's kind of what the book documents. Mm-hmm. Can you say something about that?
Yeah, so there's a two-way thing to citizen diplomacy. I want to emphasize that the Vietnamese were intentionally and strategically cultivating around the world and in the U.S. a group of people who would open their eyes and hearts to what was going on in Vietnam so that they would see that, yes, the U.S. was bombing Hanoi. Yes, this is what the Vietnamese were asking for. You would meet the farmer and the hospital worker and the teacher and so on, and just like actually talk to them. And mind you, making this act of citizen diplomacy was not half as easy as it would be now. And even now, the trip is hard. As I mentioned, like 20 hours on a plane. Back then, it took a total of 10 days to get to Vietnam on 3 different planes. The last plane has to be going through a war zone, so it has to be a special plane that was controlled by the monitored by the international. What did they call that? The ICC. I forget what it stands for right now. But it was Poland, India, and I think Canada who were in charge of that. And so to make the final trip from Laos to Hanoi, or from Laos to Vietnam, the citizen diplomats had to get on this rickety plane that only flew like every certain time. And then supposedly the airspace was cleared for this plane. But, you know, they didn't know that would really happen. So then for the U.S. side, they were citizen diplomats because they came with certain skills, whether they were writers or artists or musicians, like Joan Baez famously was one of those. And then the idea was that, somehow the trip would make an impact on them. As far as I know, the Vietnamese made no specific request, like, we just want you to come. Then when you come, you'll probably do something, but we don't know what that is, you know. Yeah. And we don't even steer which way it is, you know. And even up to now, they're still like that. Like, if you come, they show you what they show you, and they answer any question you have, but they're not going to tell you, now do this. So that citizen diplomacy was a really powerful model for today, to say that these were, you know, mostly youngish writers and artists and political people, and they maybe were disparaged among their peers, but they went anyway, and then they brought back these messages. And in the case of someone like Susan Sontag, I mean, she became very vocal in support of the North Vietnamese, until her time in the 80s when she disavowed communism and so on and so forth. But still, I mean, to the very end of her life, she was against terrorism. She was against U.S. militarism. And at that time, she was very much saw herself as an internationalist.
Another thing that is touched upon in the book that I think is kind of fascinating and not necessarily very well appreciated are the links between the anti-war movement against the Vietnam War and the civil rights movement. You reference a number of former SNCC alumni, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Frank's really emphasizing that because that's, in fact, how he became involved. He was very personally and politically invested in fighting racism. He was part of the People's Anti-Racism Committee, I think. And John McAuliffe, that's where they became friends, I think. Hmm. And, you know, a big part of what I understand black organizing at that time was, that's great. You know, white people coming from the north to help us and to learn from us, that's great. But then in the end, you need to have your own movement. You have to have your own thing. And so those who were student age, they went back to campuses and they made the war their thing. But something happened in that transition, because SDS went through a whole kind of thought process where first they were doing issues that, were of relevance to students, social issues. At a certain point, people thought that the war should become an issue, and it wasn't obvious to SDS activism at that time. And so then when they pushed that war would become an issue for the student movement, essentially what ended up happening is it became a single-issue movement. And in becoming a single-issue movement, it separated itself out from civil rights, which were still an issue, which were still live issues, right? And then what was happening on the other side is that when people like Martin Luther King or his peers would speak up, and, well, really he was kind of singular in connecting militarism and racism, people thought that was scandalous, and he was defamed for that, you know. People say that's why he died or was killed. So it is kind of interesting how the roots of this activism in civil rights were then split off. And we struggle today to make that connection back. But I think it would help if people knew the history of that split, that it wasn't just people being ignorant or people being short-sighted or selfish. There were actual political acts that punished those who made those connections.
Yeah. It's kind of fascinating. So we are in the middle of what I gather is something like a 15-year period by the Pentagon to commemorate and memorialize the Vietnam War through to 2025, you say in the book. They're devoting a lot of funding to it. In just a month or two, I guess it's September, Ken Burns is releasing a major retrospective documentary on the Vietnam War. What does this book bring to that is singular?
It focuses on the anti-war movement, and it focuses on the difficult, complex, and real decisions that young people, whether they were students or they're a little bit older like Lenny, had to make to join this movement. And mainstream narratives of the war, whether we go from the Pentagon to Ken Burns, give really sort of just a very shallow picture of the anti-war movement. The Pentagon, because of the work of some very thoughtful and intentional historians, actually has included the voices of anti-war veterans. I haven't yet seen Ken Burns' series, but I know that, you know, his narrator, Peter Coyote, is very proud of the fact that they have different voices, including anti-war activists. So it's not that anti-war activism isn't seen, but I think what our book does singularly well, and we're so happy that Just World Books would value this, and you're probably one of the very few presses who would value this, is that the anti-war movement is hardly recognized it's hardly recognized for its role and participation in ending the war. And it's not seen, I think, enough by people today as something that could happen again. Mm-hmm. I mean, people are incredulous. Like, what? End war? How is that possible?
Yeah.
And so it's important to put this model out there to say, look, this is, as Frank would say, the most massive movement against war in the history of the United States. It can happen. It happened then, he would say, and it can happen again. But what do we need to do to make that happen again? That's the question that this book helps to raise, which the other commemorative efforts around the war don't strive to pose that question.
And it's not like it doesn't have relevance, given that we are so militarily involved in so many countries and conflicts at this moment.
Yeah. It's really important for millennials to hear this, because millennials grew up in war. They were born in war. They're in war now. They have no time when they've ever seen the U.S. not be at war. So it's important for them to see people their own age took great risks. They challenged their parents. They dropped out of school. Or some of them finished school, but then went on to do unconventional jobs to devote their lives to ending a war. And that's kind of unbelievable. But once they know that, I think I've really seen like people go, wow. And I think it can really change people in terms of what they think is possible.
Well, it's a fascinating book, and thank you so much for talking with me.
Thanks, Steve.